This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hi, Jason Gibbs, Joy Production Manager. It's Radiothon time. We still need Joy and we need your support. If you appreciate our free podcast service, our voice for the LGBTI community globally, and the volunteers that make our service possible, please sign up, renew your Joy membership, or make a tax-deductible donation before June 30 to keep our service possible. You may win a prize. Head to joy.org.au and click on either the Become a Member or Donate tabs to support us. If you appreciate our podcast service, let us know in the comments section when making your donation. Joy Podcasts, where you want them, when you want them, at joy.org.au and on iTunes.
You're on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine, Brendan and Neil with you. And really excited to chat to the gentleman, Stephen Zagala. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Now, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're here from the Monash Gallery of Art. But where did you get your start in the arts?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I've only really been working at the Monash Gallery of Art for just a little bit over 10 years. Mm. And that was my first job that I would describe myself as a curator. I inherited a job that, well, I took on the job that had a collection attached to it and an exhibition schedule. So, but before that, I actually, yeah, had quite a diverse, I suppose, or zigzagging path through the arts. When I studied art history and art theory at university and then worked as a critic for a number of years and continued doing study and research and was very involved in running contemporary art spaces and that kind of scene that's so dynamic and lively in Melbourne. But then I needed a bit of a bit of fresh air, I suppose. And, you know, as great as Melbourne is, I think we all know how intense it can be a little bit, particularly if you want a bit of creative breadth to just let new ideas come in. And, I ended up working in Vanuatu for on and off for about a decade, in and out of Canberra, working on heritage projects there. So I got really back into the grassroots kind of cultural creativity and was looking at indigenous art practices through the islands of Vanuatu and working out how to preserve these oral histories and traditions, which is always, you know, it's a fascinating question that I think we can all relate to in Australia. We know that there's that constant process of, well, there has been, of incorporating indigenous traditions into what looks like contemporary art or contemporary theatre, a kind of commodification of it, I suppose, often into a Western mould. But I was involved in a very interesting project that was funded by UNESCO, and they were interested in this idea of intangible heritage. Mm-hmm. You know, so UNESCO had a long-standing thing of classifying buildings and squares and, yep, you know, things. But what do you do with oral traditions where they don't have museums or structures? Yep. And it's all about storytelling and performance and reiterating knowledge in order to pass it along. So I was involved in a very interesting process of working out how to start festivals and organise workshops that would allow older people to pass on the knowledge of their practices to younger people.
Did you notice in that time that there was sort of crossover between preserving and then sharing that information and how that worked?
Yeah, definitely. And I think this is the most fascinating thing about it for me, was seeing the way that oral traditions work on this rhythm of repetition. And it's not repetition of the same. It's not like they're standing on the spot, but the same stories, the same songs will get told over and over again, like jazz standards or something. Yeah. But there'll be constant improvisation and constant recontextualization in relation to particular contexts. So I was fascinated. I'd go to one village and I'd see this elaborate drawing done with a particular song and story. And you know, I'd go a couple of kilometres up the coast and I'd see the same drawing done, but the people there would have inflected it with a kind of politics, or the story with a kind of politics that related more to their circumstances that were different to down the coast. So just that constant, I really love the way there's just this repetition that isn't about sameness at all. It's about diversification and opening things up to new readings.
So in logistically, you know, how do you go about then preserving it? You know, is it literally recording things? and, you know, taking evidence back with you and working with them?
That was certainly part of it. Certainly recording it in the first instance was, even at a really basic level, just a way of showing an interest in it, saying, this, or, I think this is interesting. There are people in the world who would find this interesting. It isn't just something that you can, you know, you can let it go if you want. I don't want to tell you what you should deem important, but there is interest more broadly than this, and we're going to record it and record that and keep those records in the National Museum so that people can go and refer to it in generations to come. But by far and away, the most interesting aspect of the project was finding out who the experts were, finding out what context they normally shared that information, and then establish festivals, really, where people from all the islands and villages could come together and share that information with their younger people, and for the younger people to see their older people being valued by outsiders for what they do, I suppose, was also really important.
So was that a bit of a, you know, tough in a way to build up that relationship with them to get that access than to even just to begin with?
Yeah, definitely. I was aided by the role that the Vanuatu Cultural Centre plays. Right. It's a very impressive organisation in terms of its connection with grassroots creativity. You know, one of my first encounters with the cultural centre was that every year they have a little festival, not a festival, it's a conference, and they have different elders, chiefs across all the islands who are designated as their ambassadors out in the islands for the cultural centre, for the museum, and they spend their year recording stories, and they have particular themes they get sent off with, so it might be cooking one year, and they'll investigate all the different songs and methods and styles of cooking in their village, and they'll bring that all back to the museum with everyone else who's come from their villages with information on the same thing and record that and talk about it. So it really is an advocacy organisation as much as anything. And so me working on with them behind me as a representative of the cultural centre in the capital, I was able to go into these villages and they'd understand exactly why I was there and what the why custom and culture were important.
And did you find that the different tribes or groups of people were sort of like surprised that the stories were universal in a way, but obviously in their own individual contexts at the same time?
Yep. Yeah, I think they were, very much so. And we had some very interesting conversations about that that sometimes got into copyright and claims of being the originators of it. But look, I think generally, and I don't think there's anything unique about an outsider coming into a culture and saying, that is really interesting, and them saying, oh, hold on, that's just something we do with the kids, or that's something that happens on the side of a social event. Mm. But then when you encourage them to talk about it and think about it, of course, I think, well, actually, yeah, that's how my mother taught me about how this plant can be used for medical purposes or for food when there's a hurricane or those kind of things. And so I guess, yeah, and I think that's exactly the same in our culture as well. Of course, we know all these nursery rhymes and and kids' stories, and we just take them for granted. But if we stop and we think about where those stories come from, we realise that there's, you know, bigger stories and meanings attached to them.
That's incredibly fascinating. Well, we're talking with Stephen Zagala from Monash Gallery of Art. We've got a lot more to talk about on Joy 94.9. It's Sunday Arts Magazine.
Donate $10 or more across our Radiothon period until June 30 for your chance to win an 8-night, 9-day luxury cruise for one, travelling aboard the Celebrity Solstice from Sydney to New Caledonia, thanks to Points of Difference events and celebrity cruises. The more times you donate amounts of $10 or more, the more chances you have to win. Best of all donations over $2 are tax deductible. T's and C's apply. See joy.org.au. Happy Radiothon. Joy 94.9. Your voice, your radio station.
You're on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine with Brendan and Neil, and we're talking to Stephen Zagala from Monash Gallery of Art.
And you are the senior curator at MGA, which is quite the title.
Makes me sound old.
We've done a bit of a jump to your time at MGA. We'll have to have you in again to get more of your backstory. But tell us a little bit about that role as senior curator. You know, what is your day-to-day life like at work, you know, and how far ahead do you have to think in your role?
I have to think ahead in all sorts of, there's all sorts of time frames for developing exhibitions. Look, I often Well, look, I recently used the metaphor of being a sausage maker as what I do as a curator. Mm-hmm. Curating has the root of the word is the same as the word for curing meat, you know, preserving meat. Mm-hmm. You find the good things that you want to keep into the future. And that's kind of what curators in museums do. They look for the aspects of culture that they want to preserve, to keep for the future. And we go through all sorts of conservation treatments and et cetera and archiving of that material. But we're also always thinking about how we're going to slice up those delights that we've saved and share them with the public and to mix them up and to make them last as long as possible. I mean, I work with a purely photographic collection and photographs, and they're not going to last forever. I mean, we can make them last for, you know, a dozen generations if we're lucky, but at the end they're going to fade, like everything does really in the bigger cosmic scale of things. So when I think about my role as a curator, it's not just about holding on and preserving things, it's about making them last and prolonging them so that they can be shared in new contexts over and over again.
And what are some of the things that have really excited you during your time at MGA? And, you know, how do you, this is a bit of a two-parter, how do you kind of balance the subjective and the objective in terms of, what, you know, the things that you show in gallery?
Yeah, I mean, that, gee, that's a big philosophical question for a Sunday afternoon. I wonder if I can answer both those questions at the same time. Yeah, look, I think some of the things that excite me the most when I'm working with the collection is finding things that I didn't expect to be there or surprise me for some reason. When I first started, for instance, I was looking at all these photographs of pictorialist, beautiful misty landscapes and images of boats at the dock and, you know, modernist Dupin and David Moore kind of images. And I found this photograph of the performance artist Stellark hanging from meat hooks, which is what he did in the 70s, is suspend himself in the air and do these endurance exercises. So this wonderful photo of Stellark hanging from the meat hooks, and it seemed so out of place, but it also really intrigued me and delighted me, and I suppose tapped into something subjective, I suppose, so excited me for those reasons. But the really exciting thing is actually trying to unpick those subjective impulses and think about what's formed my personal tastes. Because really, I don't think that distinction between, you know, objective and subjective is really there in life anyway.
They're not polar opposites,
no.
Really.
I mean, my tastes and preferences and I'm an individual, but they've also been formed by all sorts of factors, upbringing, economics, education, all those sort of things. So I guess one of the things that I do really enjoy about working in the arts is being able to pick apart those subjective and objective things, to talk about the big forces that create who we are in the world, but also deal with those from the point of view of how it really affects us, you know, at a sensual level.
Now, you mentioned a name, Max Dupin, or Dupin.
Yeah, what's it called? Dupin. Maxime Dupin.
And he is sort of the subject of your current exhibition, which is already opened and is running till the 6th of August. And it's called Under the Sun, Reimagining Max Dupin's Sunbaker. So what are some of the... Well, first, logistically, you know, how have you collected these pieces of work and what are they?
So it's a show that's been... It's come to MGA from Sydney. It was originally organised by the very auspicious Australian Centre for Photography, which is one of the first photographic art institutions in this country. And it has asked a range of contemporary artists, from emerging artists in their 20s right through to, and I think the oldest person in the exhibition would be 70 years old, and they've asked all of them to respond to this very iconic image of Max Dupin's that everyone would know if they saw it, because it's been reproduced so often on big banners for exhibitions, as well as front page of Good Weekenders and that sort of thing. So it's an image that, yeah, has an iconic status. So all of these artists have been asked to produce new work in response to that. It's one of the good stories of the Catalyst funding program, actually. I mean, that's, you know, been canned and obviously been retracted now, I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea, but one of the things that came out of it was that there were this slush fund that was going directly to artists and creatives and not being sucked into arts administration, I suppose. Yeah. And so it did give the opportunity to, you know, a dozen artists to produce new work and get paid for it.
And what do you think from your point of view, once again, sort of objective and subjective point of view, what do they do? What do they pull apart in terms of that iconic image? Do they break it down completely?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of them, there's been a very purposeful selection of more females than male artists in the show, of course, because it's such an image of kind of white male Australian identity. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing about, this is why it's become iconic. It has come to symbolise that very narrow notion of what it means to be Australian, you know, bronzed, you know, on the beach, muscular, and, you know, of white European origin. And so all of the, well, a lot of the artists who respond to it are just kind of either queering it or introducing a kind of Islamic kind of take on what it means to be Australian, or what, or how does a female relate to the beach landscape, or as an Indigenous person, how do you think about Australian identity and the beach and masculinity? So it teases apart all of those kind of things in different ways, in playful ways, in critical ways, in sardonic ways.
And do you have fun with that yourself, you know, as much as you would have curating an exhibition then? From scratch. So it's come from Sydney. It's kind of its own animal already.
Yeah.
Do you get as much fun from something like that?
Yeah, I do, because often, and I really enjoy preparing shows, but in terms of fun, the best part of being a curator and engaging with art is being out on the floor and talking to public about shows and going through the stories. And those stories change over the course of an exhibition for me. I learn things from my audience that also get incorporated into the spiel. And it is part of an ongoing conversation. And that kind of sense of discursiveness is already there in the show as well, with, you know, 15 artists, I think, all talking about the same topic from very different points of view.
Great. And we spoke about sort of looking forward to the future. You know, what is on the horizon for MGA, Monash Gallery?
For MGA? Look, we run a program that's concerned with photography year in, year out, and that ranges across documentary and artistic modes. We also incorporate international artists as well as local artists. But after this, I guess I'm doing a show on Australians in Papua New Guinea. I've always been fascinated by the fact that Papua New Guinea is incredibly close to Australia. You can basically walk there at low tide, you know. And so I've got three very different perspectives of Australians. One, a guy whose mother was his mother is Papua New Guinea, his father's Scottish, a contemporary artist working there. Another guy, Stephen DuPont, who's much more of a photojournalist, action photographer, that, you know, in the hard places, taking the hard photos. And then a woman, Sonia Pays, who takes a much more atmospheric, environmental approach to the landscape and what it offers. So,
fantastic.
Yeah.
It sounds incredible.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.